Hello, this is the Shrink Wrapper. I'm going to introduce a wonderful novel written by Dr. Douglas Beal, an esteemed physician, and I would say a philosopher of modern times, which will be borne out upon your reading of his novel. Reading The 12 Days of Christmas led me to realize that Dr. Beal may very well be the new Dante Alighieri of the 21st century. His book may be the modern-day version of Dante's Divine Comedy from the 13th century. The reader may recall Dante's boat ride through hell and through purgatory, finally reaching paradise. His pilgrim guide through it all was the poet Virgil. Virgil shows him not only the physical route through hell, but also reinforces the moral lessons of that ride. The Shrink Wrapper will aspire to guide the reader through the 12 days of Christmas, and also to help the reader comprehend the tremendous moral value of this book. It'll be a task worthy of the most astute readers, and will be obvious once the reader gets into the book. Get ready. You are in for a rocky ride. We are born into this life without a guide, no roadmap. We have our present-day life, which shifts rapidly between awake and asleep. Often, we are unable to distinguish one from the other. Oftentimes, life makes it extremely difficult to distinguish even past from present and from future. This very situation is the sine qua non of the experience of those who suffer from what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. I believe that everyone, in a sense, who is born into this world of mortality is going through PTSD. The Shrink Wrapper hopes to be as Virgil, who wishes to guide you through your journey through hell in order to bring you through purgatory and into paradise. Okay, now we're going to find ourselves speaking to the author, Dr. Doug Beal. Hi, Doug.
Hey, how are you? It was very humbling to hear you speak of me in conjunction with a 13th century treatise that's been followed by so many for so long. And I hope to make maybe a small impact on today's readers the way many of the manuscripts that you referred to did for centuries of readers.
Right. You've got a lot to live up to, but I think you're probably not aware yet of your true identity. And I'm going to try to bring it out for you while we're interviewing this work of yours.
Well, we spoke the other night, the two of us, just so the listeners maybe will bring them up to speed, and we discussed some of life's travels that brought me to be able to write this manuscript. And in doing so, I remember you asked me, you said, Doug, how long did it take you to write it? And I said, well, I worked on it for about 4 months. And you said, no, it took you 50 years. There's a lot of truth in that. Because unless you've seen a lot in your own life, it's very difficult to write even fiction if it's not truth-based in your own realities. So many of the people that came in and out of my life, those relationships were born out onto the pages of the manuscript. And in those relationships, we've had the unusual ability and the uncanny ability to see life suffering from a different perspective. As physicians, we get to listen in and pull up a bar stool really next to people that don't always share their deepest, darkest secrets, even with their friends and family. And in that respect, I've been afforded a great tool in order to work with patients across a myriad of different physician hats, if you will. I started life as a radiologist. I've worked as a house doctor. I've spent many years in regenerative medicine and interventional pain, and you'll agree with me from your background that the pain medicine's waiting room looks very much like the psychiatrist's waiting room. And many of these people suffer from long-term anxiety and depression. I've seen people with addiction problems. I've seen people with loss. I've seen utter sadness. And I've lived on both sides of medicine where I've been both a physician and a patient. All of those relationships allow you an unusual vision of the tribulations of life. And so what I'm hoping for, as the reader identifies with the main character, Little Mikey, they'll see some of themselves in Little Mikey. And some of this, if not many of the chapters, may resonate with the majority of the readers.
Exactly. When you mentioned Mikey, I think I heard you say Mikey, and then I heard you say Little Mikey, right?
Yeah, there are two Mikeys in the novel. There's Little Mikey and his dad, Big Mike. I utilize the convention Little Mike so as not to confuse people listening this evening, but there is a significant difference between the two. in a father-son relationship. And I think all the fathers and sons who get to read this will get that feeling of the relationship based on their own relationships with their own significant others.
Okay, I'm really going to try to concentrate very carefully. Even though I am the guide, I'm going to need some guidance.
So essentially, little Mike, a 65-year-old man, wakes up at a homeless shelter December 14th of 2020. And during that day, you learn a lot about his life and how he got to be homeless and live in a homeless shelter and living in Newark. And he goes to bed that night and he wakes up and it's December 15th and it's 2008. And then it's December 16th and it's 2004 until he goes back to an inflection point and maybe God gives little Mike another bite of the apple. And really, the story is more one of hope and prayer and belief than it is anything else. And although rudimentarily it extends across the 12 days of Christmas, although the 12 days of Christmas by a good Christian, I'm obviously a bad one because I'm a bad Jew. I like to refer to my wife as an excellent Baptist. But in that respect, the actual 12 days of Christmas take place Christmas and after Christmas. But I use the convention of the 12 days of Christmas to interest the reader because most of the book unfolds on the dates between December 14th and December 25th. But it's really a story of when is it too late to hope? Does hope get you through the hardest times of your life? And is the belief in something bigger than yourself and the ability to pray to something bigger than yourself get you through those periods? So I'm hoping that the spiritual nature of the book transcends the basic religions of Judaism and Christianity and Muslim and Hindu and Buddhism, such that the reader can identify, no matter what his background is, with the idea of an almighty God being bigger than he and someone that he can relate to, pray to, and rely upon to give him hope that it is never too late.
Wonderful. I think your important reference to the different religions, which you would think would be something that would be an accomplishment for humanity to have a diversity of religious beliefs to match the needs of all individuals from all over the globe. And unfortunately, somehow we find ourselves going down through history, kind of actual hell on earth instead of paradise.
I've been somewhat horrified by 2020 in a lot of respects. I grew up in Yonkers, New York, and much of the book is based in Yonkers. And I grew up in a multicultural area with significant difference in the ethnicities. And amongst the people that I called my friends came from every color, every walk of life, every possible socioeconomic background. And there wasn't a divisive force between us, but it was a unifying force. As I grew up, I wrestled through college, and I've been an avid weightlifter and trainer my whole life. For years, I have not seen racism. I have not lived the idea that one religion is markedly different than another. And I've seen too many people use both race and religion more from a divisive perspective than a unification perspective. And if you understand the works of any physician, we see everybody the same. We all bleed red and all bones are white. And the radiographs don't differentiate between people of different backgrounds. Essentially, we see people at their core for what they are. I want to say that they're minimally relative situations that we impose on people. And if anything, I would hope that the reader looks at this book and realizes that we're all much more similar than different.
Yeah, and that even includes people from different caste systems like they used to be, maybe still is in India and in all parts of Europe and especially in the United States. Not exactly a caste system, not based on religion, but on materialism. And that includes economic status that seems to in many ways replace the religious prejudice to where all men are created equal. It turns out to be a challenge instead of a blessing that we've been trying to really bring into a reality for hundreds of years.
No, it's well put. It's funny. As I scripted the book, having read it, you'll understand what I'm talking about. There were important aspects to keep things fluent so as not to confuse people as they're reading it. But I found myself, and we talked a little bit about this off the air yesterday, that when I write, I get the sense that I'm channeling. And I never know where it's coming from, so that I have the thrust of the story of what I want to write, but I really don't know where the story is going to take me until I free write it out. Editing and looking at grammatical changes come much, much later. For me, it's the emotional fluidity of the story that makes an impact. They ask me, how much have you written? Unfortunately, most of my life, I've been shrouded in science. And most of the treatises that I've read have been based upon scientific facts that I had to look up. So I've read journals and textbooks for the majority of my life. When I read, I like to read a number of authors. I've read a lot of Mitch Albom, and I think that a lot of my writing style is tantamount to the way that he tells stories. So you learn a little bit about the plot of the story, and there's a retroflex where you go back and maybe you learn some morality, where there's an important point that you want to bring out. And I like to do that through teaching. I've read a lot of Gordon Livingston, who's another physician. He wrote Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart. Another brilliant individual who teaches through stories. And I think you've had the ability to see me on stage when I used to lecture on regenerative medicine. Stories is the way to get to people's heart, because to just give people facts, it doesn't stay with you. When you take people down the road and you realize that you're in rapport with them, they deeply understand emotionally where you're trying to go, and that they fixate upon and they'll remember, and it's something that they can build upon. And that's really the best way to teach for me.
Yeah, it reminds me of, according to Christianity, Christ didn't exactly speak in stories, but is sort of like symbolism and parables. And now to this very day, I think our stories now are kind of like descendants of those kind of methods of teaching, whereas somehow like a direct kind of cold, dry lecture that doesn't include stories and symbolism, it seems like people can go in and listen to those kind of lectures and walk away almost demented as far as how soon they leave their memory.
Yeah, I mean, when I learn something, I like it to be compelling. And if you read the 12 Days of Christmas, you'll understand what I mean, that we all have gifts. My dad was, in a sense, my best friend, and growing up, I looked at him like little Mike looked at big Mike. He had all the answers for me. He was a brilliant man that worked for years in the food industry. He worked on the atom bomb and filtered U-235 from U-238, and was really at ease equally with the president of the company and the janitor working the cafeteria itself. He was a man that with equal ease could move through different generations. He came up to college and took my friends out and be sitting there in the pub talking to them about their girlfriends and boyfriends. And he moved equally effortlessly through socioeconomic backgrounds, through ages, through people's vocations and avocations. He could talk with everybody, and they all counted on him as a friend.
Well, that kind of explains how you were able to become who you are, with a background like that, with a father like that, and share your experience in life with growing up in Yonkers and then growing up with a father who was like the epitome of the American ideal, which is all men are created equal, and you grew up with that kind of background. And that explains why the readers, if they go through this work of yours, they will be well rewarded by trying to extract the wisdom in your book, Doug.
Yeah, I tried to bring things out in each chapter that would kind of touch the souls of different people of different backgrounds. And I like to use other things to strike an emotional chord. You'll notice as you read through the book that I mentioned songs and poetry, and there's excerpts of many different songs and poems throughout the book in order to focus the reader on a certain emotionality or a certain picture that I want to get them into their own mind's eye. So we utilize different cues in order to both be in a compelling relationship with others, but many of those cues are also what ignite us internally. Some of us are visual, many of us are auditory, and very, very few of us are kinesthetic. Mm-hmm. I've utilized the songs and the prose very much in a neurolinguistic pattern in order to touch those who come from different backgrounds, so that there's a little bit of something for everybody in there.
Yeah, so you've taken the elements of the melting pot, which was in a way designed to bring people from all walks of life and all nations to this continent in order to become equal one with another. And the crises that Mike goes through in life mirrors, I think, the evolution of the constitution of this nation, the ups and downs. Even horrible things happen between the Puritans and the Pilgrims coming to America and then moving on to finding themselves not enjoying the freedom of moving to a new continent, but finding themselves under control of the old government in England, and then eventually having to actually fight for the freedom which they believed was going to come easily just by crossing the ocean.
So it's very interesting. When I hear you talk, I realize of my own deficiencies as an individual. You seem to be somewhat of a historic savant. And when you describe it, I almost look at you as you're taking apart the book as though it's a piece of art. And how does it resonate with you? And what does it make you think of? And the listeners today are getting a real treat. The shrink wrapper is probably maybe two decades ahead of me on the road of life. And obviously his eyes have seen some things that I have not. And he has delved into more of the historical perspective on how this book affects him, where many readers who are much younger won't bring to bear those memories of that type of a historical significance, but will make it more matter of fact and more literal about their present day lives. Your abstraction is phenomenal, and your ideas of looking at the world and seeing the composites of those tribulations in my book is very humbling to me.
Wait a minute, Doug. Who's interviewing who here?
I know when I'm being taught a lesson, and I appreciate it.
Reading your book loaded with more than you even realize yourself. That's why I had to get a name for you, and I hope you don't mind being Italian for a little while here.
I grew up in that neighborhood. Those were most of my friends.
We were Italian.
The Italians, yeah. And the Irish. That was the bones of Yonkers.
What a coincidence. And now I got you pegged as the new Dante. What a coincidence. You see, there's no such thing as an accident.
No, you realize as you get older that there are no accidents, and we all march along in God's major plan. The old adage that man plans and God laughs, it's true. And it doesn't mean, as a spiritual individual, that God answers every prayer. I do believe he hears everyone. And clearly there are times in my life when he is directly intervened. And if I, as a physician with a scientific background spanning many, many years, can believe in the ability of God's hand to change our lives, I think everyone else might want to buy into some of that mindset.
Well, this is the greatest time to have your book because there's so much fear, prejudice. I think really fear leads to prejudice anyway, but there's plenty of fear right now. And it's just perfect timing for this book because it's a unifying force and a teaching syllabus, actually, for getting us through hell and into purgatory. Purgatory is like a step up. People used to think that was bad, but going through the hell of COVID virus and all the shutdowns and all that's going on around the entire world, the 12 days of Christmas, the time is even perfect for this to be coming out.
Right now we're available on Amazon. See the print version, there's the Kindle. I dictated the audiobook, and that should be out within a week or so.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So I've already started on my next book. It'll be August 9th. August 9th, and through a man's life, something special happens every August 9th, and only August 9th.
Wow. Wow, that's, what's the word for this? This is like out of this world.
Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting to a lot of people. Another way to look at time.
Yeah, about time.
Yeah, at least in this manuscript, the book, The 12 Days of Christmas, is told for a large part of it in retrospect.
Yeah.
So that you're going back in time one day forward in the calendar. So although you're going from December 14th to the 15th, 16th, and so on, you're going back in years every day to look at specifically what happened on that day of that year. And in doing so, you relive many decades of little Mikey's life with him.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than growing up with him, you learn first what happens to him as an older man, homeless in a shelter in Newark. And you learn about the lifetime that drove him there and the many roads not taken and the many decisions made. And one thing that I will share with your listeners is that throughout his life, little Mikey took the high road.
Mm-hmm.
And even at the very end, he never lost his humility, his hope, or his trust in God. And that's a powerful message to look in on someone at 65 and know that they have really nothing to give, no monetary gifts, nothing in their pocket, and very little in their heart left to give. But even emaciated and unclothed and poor beyond most people's abilities to understand poverty, he still had it in his soul to give back and show love. And I think that transcendental ability to show love throughout portions of his life when he's really tried, I think that in and of itself should drive people to make better decisions and be better people, because very few people will struggle as mightily as this man did his whole life.
Yeah, goes back to another phrase, which Mikey was in the world going through like all these horrible circumstances and going through hell. And all the while, he had part of himself living not of this world, but living in paradise.
Correct.
He remained faithful. He remained loving. That scene with the scene in the restaurant where an old woman, tattered, ragged, hungry, cold, walks in with $1 in her pocket.
A middle-aged Mike stepped up and offered the little he could to someone who had less.
Yeah, and he had just lost his job, and he ended up so generous with the money he had for this very sad situation, this woman who had $1 left. She was homeless and so forth. And that when he also gave the waitress a $50 tip? Is that when that happened?
That was a different section of his life. And yes, he had been rewarded and, again, paid it forward. Much of the book, if you want to hashtag it, turns out to be paying it forward. And a lot has been said about paying it back. We grew up with the understanding that we should pay it back. It's been a new millennial generation chant in many respects. We're going to pay it forward. We're going to do it unto others. And really, that's the best thing we can do. It's very difficult for us to pay back our parents and our teachers for all the riches they've bestowed upon us.
Yeah.
But rather, we should take care of our students, our children, those who come after us. Those are the things you can really pay back by paying forward. And if there's something to be learned there, there is a portion of the book where little Mikey exceedingly pays it forward. And if the reader just hangs on and trusts in hope and prayer and gets to that point, I think they'll be rewarded.
Yeah, fantastic. The idea of paying it forward reminds me of there was a scene, I could talk to you because you grew up in a multi-religious environment. I can go back to the scene when Christ is talking to an apostle of his, a student, I might say, about this great temple that they were looking at, this beautiful temple. And they were talking about contributor, the major contributor, which in nowadays would be somebody whose name was on the front of the temple as one who contributed equivalent to like multi-billion dollars in our time. And then they said, well, look what that rich person did for our temple. And then a little old lady, maybe her name was Helen, walked out the back door of the temple as fast as she could to get away. And he says to, I think it was Peter, he says, that woman, that widow, just gave one coin, which actually is worth far more than any other contribution from anyone that you're referring to, because that coin was the last coin she had.
Yeah.
Amazing. And then sort of with Mike, it just goes back to gems from every religion. Your multi-generational, multi-denominational background is showing in and out of your book here.
Well, I guess Rabbi Hershkowitz from my youth would be happy.
Yeah, so
it's funny. I was raised where I went to school in Yonkers was a little bit dicey when I was a kid. So my folks put me in private school and they sent me to yeshiva till I was in eighth grade, from third grade to eighth grade. I remember walking to temple. I had a big friend, Barry, who was kind of like the bear Jew. He was like the biggest kid in the neighborhood who used to walk with me. And then when I drop him off at his house, I'd have to run home because kids would throw rocks at me.
Uh-huh.
And I would make it back. And by the end of eighth grade, I just told my folks that I wanted to go to a secular high school. So I went to a private high school. And then after 4 years of that, I told them I can't take all the rich kids. I need to go to a public university.
Uh-huh.
And so then I ended up at Binghamton. I ended up at a state medical school at Downstate where I did my medical training. And I look back on it, probably the best education I had was my high school years where I was at Horace Mann, but I didn't use them to the best of my ability due to the fact of my background. It was more interested to come home and see my friends than hang out with all these erudite kids from all over Manhattan and the other areas of the New York City area. So I squandered much of my 4 years of high school education not being focused on the ability to learn all the things they were giving me. But that's true with many of us. We're all subject to the emotional underpinnings of our life at that time. And I was somewhat immature and it took me a little while to learn. And that's okay. We all come into our own on our own good time.
Yeah, well, you're so lucky in moving from the, let's say, being wealthy and being in a high level of society is very dangerous situation for people to escape something called narcissism. And somehow or other, you managed one move to another towards humbleness and also to eventually, as it was growing within your childhood and adolescence, you were moving from paying it backward all the time, you were moving to paying it forward. And here you are.
Yeah, no, I think at some point in our life, we start asking the big question. How do we want to be remembered? Is there a God? What do I want my children to think of me when I'm gone? And we don't ask those questions in our youth. We're very preoccupied. What do I want to do with this job? Where do I want to live this year? Who do I want to date? And it takes time before we get mature enough that we start thinking about those third level or third order questions. I hope that maybe in reading my 12 Days of Christmas, the reader gains entry into a mindset whereby they can start asking some of those questions a little bit earlier in life. Because we're on this rock for a really small time. There's 7 billion of us. We're hurtling through space and we're only here for a little bit. So to worry about death and taxes your whole life is not going to be a productive use of your time, nor is it what God put us here for in the first place. So if we can't pay it forward and we can't make the world a better place, what are we here for in the first place anyway? So it was somewhat of a gift for me to be able to share some of my thoughts, because during COVID, I was shut down. Even elective surgeries in New Jersey, there was nothing going on. We didn't have the ability to see patients. It took a while till we were seeing people on video. And it was really a couple of months when I was home with my wife and my children, and that's what I had to do. I was reading a little bit and certainly studying a little bit, but in much of my free time, and I'm sure my wife Donna would attest to, I was writing. And I wrote probably 2/3 of this during the COVID shutdown, and maybe the last third I wrote while business was not too busy, and I would go to my office and in between patients continue writing.
Wow. You have now brought this work of art, work of science, work of religion. It's a spiritual work. And I think that is a wonderful way to end this interview, which is called an interview. I think it's a view of inner. I think it's an inner view, actually, as it's turned out. And I really appreciate having the chance to find out about your book and to talk to you about it. And if you have any other words, you've already wrapped up everything you possibly can in what you just said, but is there anything else you want to say before we end our conversation today?
No, I hope your readers go to Amazon, order the 12 Days of Christmas, read it, and whatever it does to move you inside, write about it, and take up some space on the Amazon website, and talk about what was special to you in this book, and what made a change in you, and how so did it do that. Those are things that are worthwhile, because other people will read the reviews by readers. I'm hoping that a large swath of readers from markedly different backgrounds will comment about many different things. And just like a piece of art, I don't expect anyone to read a single chapter and feel the same way about it. But if I make you feel something, then I did my job.
Yeah, I think it's going to come true, Doug. And I'm going to thank you for all the new and old and prospective readers. I'm going to speak for them now. And thank you so much.
God bless you, Shrink Wrapper. I really appreciate it. And it's very humbling hearing a man of your knowledge's perspective, because the way you see things through the verbiage of the book is a very eloquent and upper-level vision that no one to this point has shared with me.
Well, I'm so grateful for the chance to do that, and I'm going to say hasta luego, Dante.
Thank you so much. God bless you all.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.